everyone, and thanks for turning on The Blender, the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Daisy Sindelar, a writer at RFERL, and I'll be one of your hosts this week. Coming up in episode 26, we're going to take a look back at some of the best of The Blender. The first Blender podcast went out on January 14th, so we're using the occasion of our six-month anniversary to take a look at some of our favorite moments from the podcast. So I'm joined in the studio by my three fellow podcast hosts, Pavel Butorin.
Hi, Daisy.
Hi, Pavel. Bruce Jacobs.
Hello.
Hello, Bruce. And Grant Podelko.
Hello, Daisy.
Hello. Welcome, gentlemen. Grant, you were the host for the very first two episodes of The Blender, so we're going to start with you.
All right. Well, thanks, Daisy. For my first pick, I chose an interview with author Christopher Hitchens that we aired back in January. Hitchens, as he always is, was thoughtful and thought-provoking. Here he is talking to RFERL writer-at-large Jamie Kirchick about the possibility of an Iran armed with nuclear weapons.
Do you think a nuclear Iran can be contained?
No. I don't think, actually, a theocratic Iran can be contained even without nuclear weapons. I think there's a confrontation in our future between our civilization, I'll say that without embarrassment, a world that at least respects, if it doesn't always practice, the rule of law, and that has devised certain forms of diplomacy and certain systems of arms control to which the Iranians are legally signatories, and a regime that has the clearly expressed ambition to break out of and to trample all those conventions. We already see it in the threats to their Arab Sunni neighbors in countries like Bahrain, in their export of violence, as far away as murdering Jewish community leaders in Argentina, or Kurdish exiles in Berlin and Vienna, for heaven's sake, or a novelist friend of mine living in London writing fiction. I think they've asked for a fight and should know that on those conditions they certainly will get one. I was at a Hezbollah rally, well, so were you, in Beirut a little while ago, and I couldn't but notice that the party symbol of Iran's main client in that country, Hezbollah, is now a nuclear mushroom cloud. In cartoon form, the cartoon is made up of words which, when decoded, constitute a threat to the Jewish state, the Jewish people. Well, I wouldn't want to look back and think, I wonder if I should have paid attention to a threat like that. You may say one is alarmist. I could give you also all the reasons why that could be a bluff. They don't have it. They just want you to think they do. It's a way of aggrandizing themselves. I know that's all partly true, too. But behind it, there's a reality, and the reality would be the emergence of a thermonuclear theocracy. The one thing we've, since I was at school, been lying awake worrying about, what happens when apocalyptic weaponry is grabbed hold of, laid hold of by messianic totalitarian forces. Well, we are about to find out. If we want to run that experiment, they're ready to do it for us.
So that's the worst. There are no consequences of
no consequences could possibly be worse than that, because I'm not one of those who thinks they would immediately use it on the Israelis, let alone on the United States. I think they want it for purposes of blackmail, principally against other Muslims and non-Persians in the region, or at least initially. The mullahs have a great racket, bleeding their country dry and running it into the ground and sucking out the surplus. Most of them don't want to give it up. But it doesn't mean that a later regime wouldn't be much more extreme and they'd have the same weapons. So we have to take that into account. But in the meanwhile, we'd have to live in a world where perforce we were polite and accommodating and agreeable to these characters. And I decline to live on those terms. I won't do it. The best speech made by Churchill on the most overused example, of course, of this kind of compromise. But still, I think the best and one of the least known, as he finally said in one speech, is it's not that one objects particularly to any one policy, internal or external, of the Hitlerite regime. It's that you basically don't want to live on the same continent as them. You don't want to be breathing the same air. And in the long run, in fact, you aren't going to be able to. One of you is going to have to yield.
That was Jamie Kirchick talking to writer Christopher Hitchens. The full Hitchens interview can be found on episode number 2 of The Blender. And for my second highlight, I chose an excerpt from the harrowing story told by our newsroom colleague, Robert Tate, after he and a reporter from RFERL's Radio Free Iraq were detained and basically tortured by Egypt's feared Mukhabarat intelligence service in Cairo back in February. Robert spoke about his ordeal with correspondent Ron Sinovitz.
We're here with Robert Tate, and he's just returned from Cairo, where he was detained by police because he was a foreign journalist in the country. Why don't you start by telling us about your experience?
Where to begin? We were stopped by a police checkpoint roughly half an hour after leaving Cairo airport, around about Friday midday. The asked to check our passports. My colleague and I both held British passports, and they then asked to see inside my bag. When they did so, they found a satellite phone, which clearly confirmed the suspicions that we were journalists, and journalists are plainly the eye of the storm, this particular scenario in Egypt, foreign journalists, that is. And they then asked us to follow them in a vehicle they had in front, and we followed them to a nearby police station. That was followed by a wait of perhaps an hour or longer before we were taken to another facility, which I guess belonged to the Egyptian intelligence service, the Mukhabarat. And thereafter, we were held incommunicado for roughly 27 hours with blindfolds, handcuffs, and in a cell where other Egyptian detainees were being beaten and tortured with electric, either cattle prods or electrocuting devices, I'm not sure which.
You said that you weren't tortured, but some may beg to differ that being detained blindfold and forced to lie on the floor while people immediately next to you were being tortured is a form of mental torture. Did you feel at some point that you may be next? And talk about those feelings.
I had mixed feelings about it. I did wonder if I would be next. I rather assumed, because I know the Middle East and the sort of rather strange rules of the game that apply there, that I wouldn't be next because I'm a Westerner and I hold a British passport and the like, and therefore I was sort of subject to favourable treatment. But you can't rely on that. You don't know the psychological makeup of the people who are in charge of you, who are controlling you, who really have your destiny at their mercy. And, you know, it's a thin line. It's an invisible line. I mean, I wasn't physically tortured in the sense that my sort of co-inmates were, but I was roughly treated. I was pushed up against a wall, shouted at, and it could easily have come my way, and the events I described were taking place a few feet away from where I lay. There was a sound of some click, click, clicking electric rods, which were really just inches away from my face, and you never knew. You just never knew if it was going to come your way. I always felt it wasn't going to come my way, but that didn't make me any less nervous.
That was RFERL correspondent Robert Tate. The full interview with Robert can be found by downloading episode number 5 of The Blender. And now on to my podcast host colleague, Bruce Jacobs. Take it away, Bruce.
Well, I chose an interview from episode number 3 of The Blender, and I picked it not only because it's about one man's passionate fight for justice against powerful forces and long odds, but also because of his efforts over the past year. They appear to be showing some results. I'm talking about Hermitage Capital Management CEO Bill Browder. He was once the largest American investor in Russia, and his lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, died in jail in 2009 while awaiting trial on what Browder calls trumped-up charges. Now, just this week, the Kremlin Human Rights Council released a report saying Magnitsky probably died as the result of a beating and a failure to provide needed medical care. The council also accused a judge of imprisoning Magnitsky without just cause and suggested the tax fraud charges against him were fabricated. And Browder sat down for an interview in Prague with correspondents Gregory Pfeiffer and Irina Lagunina back in January. Here's part of that discussion.
Well, you've said that essentially the Russian authorities were holding Sergei Magnitsky hostage and essentially killed him. What is your proof of that?
Well, the first proof is that they arrested him for a crime that he couldn't have possibly committed. They said that he was a director of a company that didn't pay taxes when he wasn't a director of that company, and that company did pay taxes. secondly, he was arrested by the same officials the same officers that he had testified against for being involved in a major tax rebate fraud, and those officials then had him arrested after he testified against them. He was then subjected to unbelievable, undescribable torture in prison for having testified against those officers. And in the end, he got sick from the torture. They denied him medical attention, and he died. It's about as open and shut as you can get, and there's a ream, thousands of pages of documents to prove it. It's about the most provable case of false arrest and torture that you can have, because the documents are just so unbelievably compelling, which is what's inspired all these politicians from around the world to do something about this, because it's just such a black and white case.
So you actually singled out this list of 80 officials.
60, actually.
60 officials that were involved in Magnitsky's case. How would you describe this list? Is this like a state within the state, or is this a characteristic of the power in Russia right now?
The list was constructed because, interestingly, Russia has this crazy bureaucratic process, which everybody who does terrible things writes it down on a piece of paper. So as a result of true torture being done to Sergei, it was all documented. And so we were able to get the names of the judge who rejected Sergei's request for medical attention, get the names of the investigators who put forth false evidence to have him incarcerated, get the names of the prison doctor who refused him medical attention, et cetera, et cetera. So we were able to put this whole list together based on the bureaucracy's own set of documentation. In terms of your question, is this just a rogue gang or not? Well, the more that we've been public about this case, the more people who have been victimized have come forward and said, you know, it's interesting that your list of 60, these seven people did this terrible things to us or to our family or to our husband or our father. And we've been approached, I think, on 10 different occasions by people who've been victimized by the same group. And as the more people that approach us, the more it seems as if this is the criminal brigade that works for the top brass of Russia. It's not a rogue gang. This is a gang that's fully authorized to go about illegal, fraudulent business and to ruin lives and to kill people.
There's an ongoing debate that there is a split between authoritarian Vladimir Putin and would-be liberal Dmitry Medvedev, and it's just a matter of time until Medvedev seizes the reins of power more than 2 years into his presidency. Do you agree with this argument at all? Do you think maybe this is a way of distracting outsiders, the West, from what's actually going on? How do you read this?
I just look at the facts. I tend not to look at statements that are made, and I just look at the facts. And the facts are pretty straightforward. The facts are, in our case anyways, that Medvedev called for an investigation a week after Sergei Magnitsky was tortured to death, and he called for an investigation into his death. And in the year since he called that investigation, the people who tortured Sergei were promoted. They were awarded state honors, and not a single and then they blamed Sergei for the crime that he had uncovered that they had committed. It makes a mockery of this man. Now, of course, who wouldn't love to see his anti-legal nihilism campaign bear fruit? But I mean, the facts speak for themselves, and unless he wants to put his foot down and show that he's truly the man in charge, we can only conclude that he's essentially not.
That was correspondents Irina Lagunina and Gregory Pfeiffer speaking with investor Bill Browder. The full interview is available on our website at rfrl.org.
Just a reminder that The Blender is the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe. RFE brings radio, internet, and television news programming to 21 countries across the former Soviet Union, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, Iraq, and the Balkans.
And if you'd like to get in touch with us, it's very easy. Drop us a line at podcast@rferl.org or by leaving a comment on the Blender section of our website, rferl.org. And remember, you can download episodes of The Blender from our website or by subscribing on iTunes. A new episode is posted every Friday.
And now I throw it over to Pavel Butorin.
Thank you, Bruce. My first pick, I have two. So my first pick is a discussion we had in the studio most immediately after France passed a law that essentially banned the wearing of a full Islamic veil covering the face in public. That law triggered a lot of debate inside and outside France, a debate that was and remains relevant to our broadcast region. So I spoke to three colleagues from our language services, three women from different areas in our broadcast region with their own distinct Islamic traditions about their experiences. And during this discussion, they raised some very important issues such as women's rights, assimilation of immigrants, freedom of expression, secularism. Gulnaz Isfandiari is our correspondent in Washington who grew up in Iran but also went to a French school. Zamira Ishanova is a broadcaster for our Uzbek service. And Amina Umarova is from Chechnya in Russia's North Caucasus. So here's a short edit of that discussion.
When Nicolas Sarkozy suggested this law to the parliament, we were laughing because it was kind of deja vu for us because Sarkozy seemed to follow this undemocratic, quite restrictive policies of authoritarian regimes. We were laughing, you know, Sarkozy is learning now from Tashkent. So in Uzbekistan, according to the 1998 law, undefined religious clothing, because law doesn't define what does it mean, is forbidden. There is a ban to wear religious clothing in public. Islam doesn't require women to wear, you know, to cover her face fully. So that's why the government's propaganda machine is now working against this kind of Wahhabist elements, because this is this burqa, this niqab, I think comes mostly from Wahhabi sect of Islam.
Amina, how is it in the North Caucasus and in Chechnya? I understand there is a little bit of an opposite process where Ramzan Kadyrov, the current head of the Chechen Republic, he's actually trying to impose a certain Islamic dress code. Is that right?
Yeah, Kadyrov is somehow trying to force Chechen women to wear these, like you said, Islamic dress. But actually, every Chechen woman can say it's not Kadyrov's business what to wear, how to wear. And I don't think it's Sarkozy's business, too, because both of them, they don't care about women's rights. They're both pursuing their political purposes. And it's quite ridiculous when Soviet regime, I remember there were statements, just take off your headscarf. So when the new government came, it said, just put on your headscarf. In Chechnya, Kadyrov shouldn't be so concerned about women's dress. There are 5,000 dead bodies in dozens of mass graves and tens of thousands of young Chechen men who were just arrested during the wars, and they are just in Russian prisons. Why is this all about women's dress?
I think, Amina, it's exactly this. The answer to your question is exactly to divert society's attention from this kind of very big and fundamental problems. I think they always focus on this kind of things. This is, of course, political truth.
I have never heard that women get together and said what men should wear. We don't care. Just be modest, just wear, you know, proper dress, and that's it. And who cares?
If I may, Pablo, I think one thing is that missing from the debate is that forcing those women not to wear the niqab is not going to change the way they think or the way their husbands think about the whole issue, as it didn't wearing the forcing us to wear the veil in Iran didn't make us more religious or didn't make us believe that this is the right thing to do. Actually, it made us, people like me, hate it when I was growing up in Iran. To some extent, I understand that some people in France don't want to see women in niqab going outside. But as I said, I think in general, it's important to give the people the freedom to choose.
Thank you, Gulnaz.
But
yes,
Pavel, yes, I agree to a certain extent with what Gulnaz says. But at the same time, we live in a multicultural society, and France is not exception. And there should be some rules for the whole society. I believe God or your religion, your beliefs live in your heart, in your soul, and there is not much need to express it in this kind of overwhelmed way, which threatens in a way or frightens the society.
Islam says when you go somewhere, you have to act like people, like it means so society. It doesn't mean that you have to give up your culture, your traditions, but you don't have to, you know, so show them out to the people or to make other people uncomfortable, I think.
That was my discussion with Zamira Ishanova of RFERL's Uzbek service, Amina Umarova of the North Caucasus Service, and Golnaz Esfandiari, our Washington correspondent who covers Iran, on a controversial law in France banning the full Islamic veil. You can find the longer version of that discussion in episode 14 of The Blender. My next pick is an interview with Dmitry Kalinin, a virtuoso of the Russian folk instrument known as the balalaika. The balalaika is the most recognizable folk instrument in Russia, but it is also incorporated in classical, contemporary, and jazz music, thanks to performers like Dmitry Kalinin. I found out that Dmitry was coming to Prague as part of his Central European tour, and he kindly agreed to bring his instrument to our studios and share his passion for the balalaika with Ron Sinovitz, the host of our Different Beat, a segment where we explore the vibrant musical traditions of RFERL's broadcast region.
The balalaika is seen primarily as a folk instrument, but you have a vision for this instrument that's extending its use beyond folk music and street music. You're performing with full symphonies, you're performing with instruments from other cultures, from Japan, for example.
Balalaika has deep roots in our history, and now it developed, and musicians became more skillful to play this instrument, and technical possibilities grown. To jazz music, to classical music, and music which is by contemporary composers, especially for this instrument.
Would you be able to show us a small sample of a Russian folk song?
Of course, the most popular Russian folk song. Some classical.
In the history of the balalaika, at some times this instrument was banned from the church and by the state. Can you explain to me the history of that?
Russian Tsar Alexei Mikhailovich, Alexei Silent, in 1649 gave an order to gather all the Russian folk instruments, including domras, balalaikas, and woodwind instruments, and took them to the Moscow River and burned it, because Russian people, instead of going to church and praying there, they go into streets, dancing and drinking and having fun with that musicians. They won't go to church, and they, Tsar and church, decided with this way get rid of Russian folk instruments. But fortunately, they are not succeeded. Of course, classical musicians, performers on folk instruments, no matter balalaika or mandolina or bayan accordion, they just propose peace and beauty and harmony. So we couldn't spoil something, really.
This was Russian balalaika player Dmitry Kalinin speaking to Ron Sinovitz and playing the balalaika in our studio. It was very exciting to have a musician of this caliber in our studio and actually watch him play this amazing instrument. We have two video clips on our podcast page on our English language website of Dmitry playing a Russian folk song and Paganini. That's quite a treat. A longer version of this interview is available on episode 21 of The Blender, which was hosted by Grant Padelko. And I throw it back to Daisy.
Thanks, Pavel. Okay, for the first of my items, I picked a segment from episode 18 that was taken from an occasional video series we've produced for the website that's called Inside Joke. The idea behind this project was to take colleagues from our different broadcast services, sit them down with a cup of coffee or perhaps something slightly stronger, and just have them tell each other jokes, either in English or in their native language. And the goal was to see whether humor varies from nation to nation and how jokes can mirror a country's vision of itself. And we've done this with several services already, Georgians and Tajiks, among others. And I think we've had varying degrees of success. But I think we were most successful when we sat down with our colleagues from Belarus.
What will a Belarusian policeman do if he is ordered to catch a rabbit? Do you know? The answer is he will catch 10 rabbits and then he will release 9 of them.
Are there a lot of jokes about policemen?
I think so. But there are also a lot of jokes about rabbits, so you will hear another one, I guess.
Звери бегуть з лесу, у паніці.
Animals are running out of the forest. They are in panic. Someone asks them, "What's going on? What's the matter?" Some animals say, "The king of the beasts, the lion, is tearing off everyone's fifth leg." "So what's the problem? You've only got 4 legs." "He tears first, and then he counts."
That's very Belarusian.
Лукашенко веде перемовы у Кремля з Медведевым, раптом ему на мобильник телефонный звонок.
Lukashenko has a meeting at the Kremlin with Dmitry Medvedev. Suddenly, Lukashenko's mobile phone rings. He says, "Just a moment, Dmitry Anatolievich." He answers the phone, listens for a minute, and then begins to speak.
Доброе, доброе.
Good, good, bad, good, bad. This goes on for 10 minutes. Medvedev has no idea what's going on. Finally, Lukashenko finishes his conversation and hangs up the phone. "See how much the people of Belarus depend on me? They can't even sort potatoes when I'm gone."
So that was members of our Belarusian service sharing a little political humor with us. The full video is available on the multimedia section of our website. The second item I wanted to highlight is from a roundtable discussion I hosted back in February on the German-based disco group Boney M. The official justification for the discussion was the death of the band's frontman, Bobby Farrell, a month or so earlier. The unofficial justification was my never-ending fascination with this band, which is so odd and yet so dearly loved in the former Soviet Union and elsewhere. For the podcast, I spoke to broadcasters from Georgia, Bulgaria, and Iran, all of whom had words of love for Boney M. And here we'll listen to David Kakabadze, the head of our Georgian service. I asked him if he remembered the first time he heard Boney M.
I remember it exactly, because it was New Year's Eve, 1976, and I was watching TV. So it was quite common in the Soviet Union that on the New Year's Eve, after 12 o'clock, everybody sat in front of TV sets and watched. And even if I was 17 at that time, I was among those who sat in front of the TV set. Because in Georgia, there used to be a musical show. And it was a kind of legendary person for Georgia because he managed somehow to present musical pieces and videos to the people which were forbidden in the Soviet Union. And this was a talk show. This was a show called Estrada da Tana Medrojeva, which means pop music and modern times, if you translate into English. And it had to be also critical, obviously. So he had to tell stories about those musicians, whoever he presented, say something bad about the capitalist world, and then present the video itself. So everybody knew that this person didn't really mean what he was saying, but for him this was the only way to educate people. And so this was the, let's say, 1st of January 1977, when I first heard Boney M, and it was the song Sunny. And And this song really became a hit in Georgia. I had a classmate, for instance, who had a video recorder and who had recorded this song. And we were going to him and listening again and again, even if I personally was not a fan of disco music. But this song really, really fascinated me.
That was David Kakabadze, the head of RFE's Georgian service, remembering the very first time he heard Boney M. To listen to the full conversation, you can download episode 4 of The Blender. And with that, we here at Blender Central are signing off for the week. I'm Daisy Sindelar, and thanks for joining me, Grant Podelko, Bruce Jacobs, and Pavel Butorin for some of our highlights of the past 6 months. We'll be back next week with some new original content. In the meantime, we'll take you out with another Boney M. classic, Rasputin, or as it's better known, Ra-Ra Rasputin.
There lived a certain man in Russia long ago. He was big and strong, in his eyes a flaming glow. Most people look at him with terror and with fear. But to Moscow cheeks, he was such a lovely dear.
And his hunger for power became known to more and more people. The demands to do something about this outrageous man became louder and louder. Russians.